Hello, and welcome to episode 25 of the Outrider podcast. I am Jason Quinn Malott, and it's the 29th of December. This is going to be the last episode of 2014, and then we're going to move on and do some fun stuff in January. But I hope you all had a wonderful holiday, whichever holiday you happen to celebrate, whether it's Christmas or Kwanzaa or Hanukkah or Festivus or, you know, some pagan thing involving massive amounts of alcohol and fornication, kind of like, you know, the old Christmas before Queen Victoria got a hold of it and, you know, put a chastity belt on it and did nasty things with Santa Claus behind her backs. Wow. Yeah, maybe I should stop winging these. Anyway, today's guest is Fred Ramey. Fred Ramey is my editor from Unbridled Books, one of the co-publishers, along with Greg Michelson, there for that estimable, am I going to say that word wrong, Akili? The fabulous press, Unbridled Books. And, you know, I think you guys are going to enjoy this conversation, mostly because I get out of the way and let Fred talk. And he has some great things to say about books and literature and the publishing industry in general. And I think you're really going to enjoy it. I think this is a really good episode, and let's have me just get out of the way and get right to my conversation with Fred. So here you go.
Hello.
Hi, Fred.
Yes.
This is Jason. How are you this evening?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
About average.
Oh, was it a bad day?
Well, it's always a long day. I'm still forcing myself to get up, you know, between 5 and 5:30, and you know, sit and stare at a blank screen for a while. And
well, good for you. Just lock the door and stay in there until the muse arrives.
Yeah, usually the muse arrives about 5 minutes before I have to take a shower and go to work. So
you know, this I think is a standard experience, isn't it?
I think so. It is. I think it is. I've. That's, you know, except for those lucky few that that have managed to, you know, to, you know, be full time writers.
Oh, we don't really trust them.
Yeah, they shouldn't. They shouldn't be trusted at all. Real quick, what I wanted to do first. I mean, we're already going, so we're they'll get all of this fun stuff. But what I wanted to do first was apologize for flaking out on you a year ago when I was in Colorado and, you know, kind of fleeing town without following up with you.
That's okay. People flee from me all the time.
Well, I think that was more just a
There are many more interesting things in Colorado than me.
Well, I don't know about that. that vacation was little side story off in the hinterlands here, but that was kind of the straw before the straw that broke the camel's back, kind of.
Uh-huh.
And by January, Rebecca and I had broken up, so that was kind of a tough vacation. The other thing
that
about
is hard.
Yeah, the other thing about that one was that I'd been on, my doctor had been putting me on cholesterol medication. Mm-hmm. Because apparently, you know, I was passing out, and then they found out wasn't really anything else wrong with me except my cholesterol was like 340.
Mm.
Right. And I'm only 40 years old.
That's a notable number.
That's what they tell me.
Yes.
You
should be taking pills for that.
And, well, apparently I don't tolerate statins well.
Your legs tingle or what? you get false rings on your cell phone.
No, I turn into a gas bag. It's horrible.
Well then, you know, I'm pleased that you didn't come by.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we got to our hotel room in Boulder, and I spent an hour and a half in the bathroom. You know, so wait, that's way too much information.
I think you should edit that right now.
Well, you know, considering some of the conversations I've had with the podcast so far, it's perfectly rational to leave that in there.
Hey, it's up to you. Your name's on it.
Right, right. I mean, let's see. With Brian Ferry, we discussed dinosaur slash fiction. With Teresa Romaine, who writes historical romance. We discussed Yeti porn. All of which are trends in the self-publishing world.
Are they really? You know, I don't want to know any more about Yeti porn.
Yeah, I didn't either, but we went there. So what I always like to do with people first is kind of start with an origin story because, you know, I don't have a huge audience, but I don't know who they are, and I don't know what they know or don't know. So you, of course, are one half of the publishing editing duo that is Unbridled Books. The other one is Greg Michelson.
Yes.
And you guys have been...
The estimable Greg Michelson.
And you guys have been doing... Well, had Unbridled Books since 2003, correct?
Yes. Actually, I think it's 2004.
Okay.
Yeah, it's 2004.
And if I remember right, you guys have been kind of literary sidekicks since you were in the graduate program at Missouri. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's actually that's true. I used to tell that story a lot, which I don't anymore because it is so old. But Greg and I spent an awful lot of time as graduate students at the University of Missouri in Columbia arguing about what makes a good novel and what can't make a good novel. We don't come down on the same side of that discussion, which is why it was heated, lively, and long, and I used to say, and it is true, that we just never stopped arguing about it. So we still basically have not finished that discussion. And the reason I pause in the middle of that sentence is that I've begun to notice that in recent years, we used to be very careful about not letting anyone know what book that we published had been edited by which one of us.
Right.
You know, and the reason was that we didn't want to be pegged that way when indeed we were trying to open ourselves up. Mm-hmm. So you know, we didn't want to, after I published Insect Dreams by Mark Estrin, which, you know, is just a masterpiece of a novel. I mean, mm-hmm. I genuinely believe that, a novel that will be read in the ages, but... Insect Dreams. The main character of Insect Dreams is Gregor Samsa.
Right.
And after I published that, and people found out that I had acquired and edited it, I started getting manuscripts that had first person narrators who were non human. You know, and I got all kinds of insect books and goat books and.
Right.
You know, and so anyway, we used to be very careful about that, but I have noticed recently that some of Greg's books are books that I would have acquired and published, and vice versa.
Right.
So we're not so careful about it any longer. So maybe that argument is reaching its end, but that argument it went on with every acquisition. Uh-huh. That we made, starting in the McMurray and Beck days.
Right, right.
We would sit down and pick up the same conversation we'd had as graduate students in the literature department and, you know, talk about what you can and cannot do in a novel.
Right.
And you know, whoever won the argument. Actually, the way it started, it wasn't really who won the argument. The way it started really was that we each had veto power.
Oh, I see.
You know, so if one of us really believed in a novel, and we'd never published a novel that one of us did not wholeheartedly believe in the value of.
Right,
wholeheartedly.
Right.
And usually it's both of us. It is almost always both of us. However, in the process, you know, if the other guy said, you know, no.
Right.
then we'd let that manuscript go, and now here we are 20 years down the road, and each of us still grouses about when that had happened to
right.
to a book we really loved. Still do, but
I I think that's part of the strength of Unbridled Books and some of and your earlier endeavors is that that conversation. You know, one of the first things when I've talked to other Unbridled authors on this podcast and in person, one of the first things we always ask each other is, well, who's your guy? Are you a Fred guy or a Greg guy? And you know, it's interesting that I don't think we as writers can. Maybe some of the other people have been able to tell the differences who acquired who, but I haven't. You know, and
It has been an ongoing conversation, and people have often said that to us. You know, that they don't know which of us brought the book in. Mm-hmm. We're not so careful about that any longer. I mean, I think it's such a rich and emotional relationship that you develop with your authors. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's kind of an ongoing thing, and trying to be coy about it seems silly. And it was, however, early on, it protected us from getting a lot of targeted manuscripts when it was better, I thought, better, you know, for a manuscript to arrive blind, mm-hmm. you know, either in my box or in his box. Wow. You know, and then we'll see whether it generates a conversation or not. So, and that seemed to be a productive way to go. But now, as we've been doing this for since 1992, I think, mm-hmm. You know, we're tremendously proud of the number of authors we've introduced and the people who've stayed with us and also the people who've gone on to further success. We're proud of that too. And you know, we feel it when good things happen for our authors, and we feel it when that doesn't occur. So it's a more personal thing, and I think we're willing to be a little bit more public about the ownership we take.
So what is the basic division then? What's the basic? Can you summarize the argument? Where's the what can and can't be put into a novel according to you and Greg? What's the
No, I could do that. Yes, I could do that, but no, I will not.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I think one of the extraordinary. I'm sitting here looking at the shelf that I have devoted mm-hmm. to. Unbridled. My shelf for Blue Hen Books and McMurray and Beck is in the other room.
Right.
But you know, all told, I think it probably comes to I don't know something over 200 books.
Wow.
The vast majority of them novels. And mm-hmm. and I think as I look at the shelf, you go everywhere from Tufts, you know, a very recent publication last season by Ed Falco, who wrote The Family Corleone. It goes everywhere from there to The Annotated Nose by Mark Esper. You know, I mean, the books are not at all alike one another.
Right, right.
But they are, I think, all of them. Extraordinary accomplishments, and that's what makes Unbridled Books, I think, so extraordinary, is that there is no real commonality amongst the books other than their quality.
Right.
And if I were to divide this argument that Greg and I have had for these many years, if I were actually to broadcast that, well, this is what he thinks, and this what I regarding narrative, I think that'd be downright destructive.
Yeah, yeah, you're probably right. You are right. Not probably right. You are right. That would.
Oh, good.
I would love to know. I would love to be, you know, privy to that argument. But then again, you know, no.
Well, I'm not going to tell you when you're not recording me either.
Right.
Because that would be, you know, I imagine there are a lot of agents who'd like to know that too.
Right. Right. What's the trick? What's the key? Yeah. And of course,
I have over the years noticed that there are perhaps a few like subplots
uh-huh.
that reappear, you know, and I'm not sure how specific I want to be about that, but I do know that the vast majority of these novels, I think, place misfits in misfits of that's a you know of many different ilks,
right?
You know, but characters who don't quite fit into their world, into various contexts, some of which are historical, some of which are contemporary, some of which are non-realistic,
right?
But you know, they're all so voice-driven,
right?
That they're voice-driven. They are place-informed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's very much a track of a character's relationship to the place she or he lives in,
right?
And how that forms the way the character sees the world and thinks.
Those are sufficiently vague enough that it could be anything, which is a good thing because, like, as you know, if you did reveal the argument, all you would get for like the next 20 years would be, you know.
Yeah, and I don't want any more
books about dogs,
books.
Right?
That's right. I don't want any more insect books. And
you know,
and by the way, I've worked for decades to make my name as for speaking vaguely. Go ahead, nail me down.
That's okay. That's all right.
I'm
willing to leave it. I'm willing to leave it vague. You know, I guess. I was just always kind of curious about it. There's that little bit of curiosity. There's always that curiosity to try and understand the dynamic, because you know, when I was talking to Emily early on in the history of this podcast, we were
Emily Mandel.
Yep.
Yeah.
We were kind of pondering, like, why hasn't Unbridled gotten some of the love that like Grey Wolf or Coffee House has gotten, you know, recently. You know, where's that? Why does it always seem that, you know, writers kind of vanish from Unbridled right before the big one?
You know, the reason for that is that we have done traditionally what we have done what traditional publishers always did,
right.
Mm-hmm. which was that we stay with the authors. While they develop their readership,
right,
and we're very proud of that. I mean, we're trying to debut novelists every season. We have always tried to do that, and then to stay with that author until that notice comes. But when that moment arrives,
right,
that the notice is about to come, we know it. We know that the author is there, and so does New York.
Right.
So you know, I've never. It's part of what we do that we publish people and publish them again and publish them again, and then we lose them, and we know that that's going to happen.
Right.
That does not make it easy. It's frustrating sometimes.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and as I said before, you know, you really develop a relationship with an author when you're working on. I always say that an author's entire self is on the page.
Right.
And that's true of everybody virtually everybody who writes. I mean, sure, I'm sure there are hacks out there, but you know, people,
and
people
some of them
who
make a lot of money.
Yeah, well, maybe, if you're writing a serious novel, your heart's on the page.
Absolutely.
And even if it's a failed novel, your heart's on the page.
Right, right.
You know, so if you're an editor who cares at all about that book, you end up caring about the heart that's on the page.
Right.
And you develop this relationship with the author sufficient that when that author does get the opportunity, while you are, or we genuinely are proud and understanding when that happens,
mm-hmm.
that does not make it easy to take because we do have a personal relationship with them.
Right.
You know, so that's why it happens that way, is that we try to bring the author to that place. Mm-hmm. And sure, I'd really love the success that happened when they're with Unbridled. But, you know, I always tell the author, you know, if you get a good offer that way,
right,
you take it. It will buy you a lot of time to write the next book.
Right, right.
You know, and you deserve the payday. Your agent probably deserves the payday too. but you do. You deserve the payday and good luck and I hope it works. There are as we all know, there are dangers in it.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, there really are. Still, you know, I mean when the author gets the chance, the author should take the chance. And we basically know that going in.
Right, right.
That does make our row pretty hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I would love to get the kind of attention that all of our authors deserve. That's how they got to be Unbridled authors because we believe they deserve that attention.
Right.
I wish they could get it while they were Unbridled authors. And they often do. They often do. We have had, you know, I mean, the books are reviewed usually wonderfully,
mm-hmm.
and you know, quite often in the right, you know, in the big places.
Yeah, I mean,
so it does happen that they get attention, but I want that attention for all of my authors,
right.
Because you know, as Greg says all the time, you know, our egos, his and mine,
mm-hmm.
our egos are invested in the books we put our colophon on.
Absolutely. I mean, I've always said I say it and always throw in the little nugget just to satisfy my own need to appear to be humble, but. I will say that, you know, except for my book, there's not a dud.
No, don't say that. Don't say that. Your book is an extraordinary experience. I mean, it has that. It's the voice-driven, place informed, smart, emotional, reflective book with enough story to turn the pages. That's what we look for. That's what your book is.
Thanks, boss. but I am getting better about not putting that out there.
Yeah.
I am saying, but I do make a point of saying to people that are interested, you know, there is not a dud. Go through the whole catalog on Unbridled. There's not a dud, and there's no reason why one of those books should not have gotten more attention than it did. No reason.
Yeah, I think I believe every one of them deserves more than it did.
And
that's true.
You know, I think you know. Emily's recent, you know, finalist thing with Station 11 is proof that whatever you guys are doing, whatever that argument and that longstanding debate about what should or should not go into a novel has, you know, that's a total validation, not just for her, but for you guys and recognizing that talent.
You know, we feel that way. I hope it's okay for the... to say that we're proud of the success that Emily has, we're proud of having done her first three novels, you know, which are really
excellent.
Wonderful books.
They're
excellent books, and we've been telling people for years, pay attention to this author.
Oh yeah,
you know, her talent is extraordinary,
and she's cute too. So what are you going to do?
She's, you know, more important, she's really nice.
Right. Yep.
She's good people. You know, and that's, you know, that when you see the success come to people, to authors who are also good people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, you feel like you're doing the right thing. You know, and I'm sitting here looking at the shelf, and I wanted to call out to everybody on it.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I wrote down a list of, on my notebook here, of you know, people that I've talked to or met who you've published over the intervening years that I wanted to shout out to. And we've got Emily so far, but yeah.
Yeah, there are so many here. And And some of them, sadly, came and quietly went, you know, and which hurts us as much as it did them, I know. I mean, didn't somebody once say that the worst thing that can happen to your novel is it's published and nothing happens?
Yeah.
You know, and that's true, but it's not an uncommon experience.
Right.
But how hard that is. But we know how good they are.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing that we try to do here is we try to not to stop saying that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that we will years down the road be calling out to these authors, be sending. I still send, you know, when I think I find somebody who's a good match for a book in the backlist,
mm-hmm.
that person gets a copy of the book, you know, and a cover letter from me that says, you know, I really think you need to know about this author.
Right.
You need to know about this book. And you know, I call that patience on our part, and maybe that's a misnomer, but we do our best to promote books for a very long time and for or wherever we can.
Right, right.
You know, and that's part of staying with an author. You know, we have so many authors that we've published more than one book by.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
You know, and that's just part of that's we. The sales of your first novel are not a determinant of whether we will take your second novel.
Right.
And it is in New York. And it's not here.
Right.
You know, whether we'll take your second novel or not, you know, or your third novel, or your fourth novel. You know, maybe I shouldn't go there, but we have had authors who, you know, the second novel maybe didn't work. You know, but the third one did,
right?
You know what I mean? That the third manuscript did. So you know, we're trying to take care of authors' careers,
right?
And sales is not the determinant.
Mm-hmm.
And now that Greg and I are the owners of Unbridled, we can say that without having to answer to some board or
right.
professor or something. Mm-hmm. Sales are not the determinant.
So, what year was it when you first walked into McMurray and Beck? I mean, really, how long has your career as a publisher and editor been? And what would you say has been? I mean, ebooks. Everybody talks about ebooks, but what would you say has been the and conglomeration? Take out ebooks and conglomeration. What has been the biggest change that you think has happened with publishing?
That's two different questions. You know, the first is, you know, when did we enter this?
Mm-hmm.
I entered McMurray and Beck. I took over McMurray and Beck, which was a little self-publishing effort when I took it over. I think that was 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 92, in 1992. And then in 1993, the owner of the company said that she wanted to publish fiction.
Right.
And I said, well, okay, but, you know, I'd love to. That's, you know, that's where my life is. But it's really hard to make money that way.
Right.
The first novel we published was a novel called Stigo by Laura Hendry.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent out a good number of them. Quite a few thousand copies of that first novel.
Right.
They all went out to the bookstores and they all came back. Virtually mm-hmm. all came back.
Wow.
And 2 months after they all came back, she started getting nominated for awards.
Oh.
And she was nominated for quite a few. The Rosenthal Foundation Award, I remember.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm going to misspeak if I name another, but there were three major awards that she was, well, major, second-tier awards that she was nominated for. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful little book. Sorry, I'm fighting off a tangent here.
Oh, go. It's what we're here for.
I don't know if you've seen my Facebook page, but yeah. But the banner on my Facebook page is a stone in a garden that says, "What lasts?"
Uh-huh.
Which I love the idea of that being carved into a stone. There's no question mark after it. There's no period after it. It just says what lasts, and it's a river stone about a foot in diameter, and it sits in my front garden. And that's I had that made. It's the title of a chapter from Steigo.
Oh, nice.
That was the tangent I was fighting off. Suddenly we discovered that we could be pretty successful in publishing fiction. All of those copies that had gone out and come back, they went out again.
Nice.
You know, so Laura opens that door for us, that door of recognition for us. Mm-hmm. So that was about 1992, and that is the time that the changes were beginning.
Right, right.
You know, so we went through, Abbe McMurray and Beck, we went through the rise of the chain bookstores.
Right.
And that seemed like the most difficult change to navigate. Can you navigate a change? Mm-hmm. The most difficult change to navigate, something that I'd never expected. There's a story there somewhere that gets all muddled up about how McMurray and Beck came to an end and it morphed into McAdam Cage.
Uh-huh.
At the time it morphed into McAdam Cage was after I left.
Right.
Greg left. And we were given our own imprint at Putnam, mm-hmm. which was called Blue Hen Books.
Right.
And it fell afoul of politics when changes were happening at Putnam,
mm-hmm.
As it was becoming Penguin USA. And so we went back. The Blue Hen, wait a minute, let me. We're doing tangents here, right?
Yeah.
Blue Hen Books, which was the name of our imprint at Putnam, is actually a horse
right.
breeding term.
It's not a
so
chicken.
A blue hen is a mare that produces a line of winners.
Nice.
Sufficient to change the breed.
Right.
And it seemed like a good name for our imprint at Putnam because Greg raises thoroughbreds.
Yep.
So
I see his
when that sort of didn't work out, which again is really you know it's a story you know we can't ultimately tell you know
right.
it was a difficult time, and so when we left. We wanted still to maintain this sort of horse-related image,
mm-hmm.
and we felt ourselves freed back into independent publishing.
Right.
And so we called it Unbridled because that was better than Spit the Bit. but at any rate, when we got to Unbridled and we're publishing independently again,
uh-huh.
That coincided with the rise of the e-books.
Right.
So our first effort at publishing fiction, we are a for-profit effort.
Right. Yeah.
This is a commercial. We publish what I refer to as commercial literature,
mm-hmm.
which makes some people giggle. But
right.
That's what we do. It's a commercial effort that we have here. We did not have not-for-profit status.
Exactly. Yeah.
The first time we attempted this was with McMurray and Beck on the Rise of the Chains. The second time was with Unbridled Books, and that was the rise of the e-books.
Right.
So when you know I thought we had negotiated the most difficult waters. with the rise of Barnes & Noble, I had no idea.
Right.
Mind you, neither is anybody else.
Oh, yeah.
I would like to say, in these tangents, by the way, that I published my first ebook at McMurray & Beck in 1995.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
It was by Fred Royce, whom I still publish.
What did anybody read that on?
their computer, theoretically, but I don't think anyone. But we tried that, you know. So so what I'm saying is that you know, we've worked hard to roll with these changes.
Yeah.
And not to panic over them. And what I have said from the very beginning is that I understand that it's changing constantly how one publishes.
Right, right.
But we can't let it change what we publish. And we have to have our focus on what we publish. And if we do that, if we publish what should be published,
right,
we publish the best reading experiences that we can find, then you know, the rest of it will muscle our way through.
Right.
But let's start with the good content. You know, let's start with a beautiful novel. Let's start with a novel we're proud to publish and that we think people want to read.
Yep.
You know, and then that delivery system, you know, that constantly changing delivery system.
Right.
Let's at least have something solid at the core, and that's the books.
I don't think paper books are going away. And there's some new, you know, surveys and stuff they've found of particularly of young readers is that they're shunning the e-readers. They actually are young people are actually going for the books. They're doing it.
Yeah, no, we can talk endlessly. I think about that. That reality, although anything that I say about that reality is pretty easily dismissible by citing my age.
Yeah, well,
you know, so I try not to make that argument anymore. But I don't think books are going. I think it's a parallel. They'll exist. They'll coexist.
Right.
With e-books for a very long time, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and which you know, it's a question of do we bundle or not. Do we give up the print book.
Yeah. I mean, what I've found just because I have an e-reader now and from what I've seen is always more readily available for the e-reader than anything else is that I tend to use my e-reader for genre fiction. I mean, really narrow stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm going to sit down and actually, you know, read a piece of serious literature. If I'm going to read, you know, Emily's book or Laird Hunt's book, Never Home, which was really good. If you haven't found that one yet,
he's a wonderful writer.
Oh, excellent! But
yes,
I'm going brilliant. To sit down and read that on a piece of paper. I'm not going to read that on an ebook. You know, they've also been doing little studies and find out that that your level of retention and engagement with the text is deeper with paper than it is on the e-reader.
Hmm.
So.
Well, I have long thought that the e-books are perfect. This is I think I'm probably repeating exactly your point.
That's
e-books are wonderful for the books you consume.
Right.
But for the books you live with,
mm-hmm.
they're not quite so wonderful. They're not quite appropriate.
Right.
To the experience of the book that defines you in some way that is part of your intellectual and emotional history.
Yeah, and it's hard to clutch an e-reader to your chest in quite the same way.
It's true, and you can't. It's not even like having a concert ticket stub that you can put on the bulletin board.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, so you need the artifact. I mean, people have pointed out before that the first gifts that were given as birthday gifts and event gifts were books.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a reason for that. I think that it's a very personal selection process to pick out a book for somebody you care for.
Right. Right.
And give to them. And books do have that function. Of saying the thing that you can't say
mm-hmm.
concretely, you can say it abstractly by giving the right book. But there's, you know, books have value as mementos.
Right, right.
Mementi?
What's the plural of it?
Yeah, whatever.
I have no idea. I'd have to look it up.
But for the book you consume. You know, the book you read for the quick diversion,
right, to pass time and
or the quick enjoyment. Certainly, an e-book's perfect for that.
Yeah.
But you realize that as we enter this conversation, that we start to step onto the dangerous ground, where you make a decision about the value of a particular novel. One's consumable, and one is one you live with. There are, you know, I've said that now three times, and there are people who will accuse me of elitism.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, oh god. I recently put up a post on my blog about this was maybe 4 months ago. You know, because I was getting tired of making little comments about how frustrating query letters were, and having people who know me but haven't, you know, been in the same room with me in like 20 years going, why don't you just self-publish?
Yeah.
I'm going, So I sat down and wrote this thing, Why I Will Never Self-Publish.
Yeah.
And I, you know, broke it. For me, it's all it comes down to two things, economics and speed. Because if I'm going to self-publish a book, I want to publish it as close to professional as I can. So that means hiring an editor, hiring a book designer, you know, securing some means of distribution other than Amazon. And all of that costs money. And I figured even doing it on the cheapest route possible, it's going to cost me $3,000 or more. To do that. And it's like,
yeah,
I would have more. To, yeah. And I would have to take out a loan to do that.
Yeah.
And
when we get to this topic here, you know, of self-publishing, mm-hmm. I have, as someone who has trouble with authority, I think that there's something to be celebrated in the self-publishing movement.
Oh,
you know, because it is a revolution, and it does put power into the hands of the people.
Right.
And it does keep you from being silent by enabling you to have your own outlet.
Right.
You know,
correct.
And I you know, the old radical in me supports all of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's giving voice to the people, and I support that.
Right.
It makes it really hard for me to make a living, though.
Exactly. And
there are other arguments too, you know,
right,
about, you know,
right,
what is the value of traditional publishing, and I feel that all of those things that you just outlined, this is what the publisher brings. Mm-hmm. You know, we try to publish the book right.
Correct.
You know, we try to get it distributed in the right way. We try to position it in the right way. We try to get mm-hmm. We try to take the time that's involved in publishing a book.
Right.
You know, which is, I'm now dealing with my distributor regarding the books that we will release in the spring of 2016.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it takes a very long investment of time to publish a book. To give that book a chance at success in the marketplace, even
right.
though in 2016 the marketplace might be different and the delivery system might be different,
right.
but still, that's what publishers do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that there are it's a complex question about self-publishing.
Yeah. And that's why that post of mine was huge. It was enormous, and I tried to address everything, including the fact that, you know, there's some things as a writer, if you take on that role of publisher, then you have to do things that you might not have the skill or the talent to do. It's like my big thing with, aside from that, I have to take out a huge loan to just get an artifact created. I would have to do all of my own marketing and publicity, and I'm terrible at that.
Yeah.
I don't have that talent. And, you know, and then of course the speed thing is that I've done a lot of research into into what turns out to be a successful self-publishing book. And every now and then they'd like to pull out the little individual stories about the someone who writes a literary book that suddenly Penguin decides they really like and want to throw out there. But most of what succeeds in self-publishing is niche genre type of stuff, like vampire romance or something, that's done in a serial mode where the writer produces one or two books a year in that series. And that can kind of make up and compensate for a lack of skill in marketing and publicity.
Yeah.
But I don't write that fast. You know?
I see what you mean by speed.
Right. You know? And,
yeah, you know, and I do say to my authors all the time, you know, that, well, you know, while we're working on the that long process of publishing
right.
your book, you should be writing the next one.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
you know. I mean, writers, authors, I think should be writing,
right?
Not fighting these fights that are, you know, practicalities.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, and indeed, I understand that when you do succeed as a self-publisher, you get all the benefits of that success.
Oh yeah,
I understand that, and I understand why there are some people who are tremendously pleased by their experience with
right.
self-publishing, you know, that experiences they wouldn't have had if they had been published
right.
traditionally, or had attempted to publish traditionally and weren't published.
Right. And
you know,
some,
and I get that.
And for some reason, a lot of the people that are very pleased about the prospects of self-publishing tend to come at me just with the economic angle of it. Oh, you can keep all your rights and you can keep all the profits. And it's like, yeah, but
yeah.
I would have to do all this stuff that I even am not good at and don't have
yeah.
the time for.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's right. And if you succeed, it looks like it was a good decision to self-publish.
Right. And if you don't, then you're
out the money. You're out the time.
Right. And
you may have missed a novel that you were supposed to be writing.
Yeah. And it also kind of, you know, if you're not prone to, I always think if you're not prone to writing genre, if your brain doesn't, you know, spend all your time thinking about, you know, science fiction and aliens or vampires or all this stuff, which sometimes people hear me talk about that and they think, oh, you don't like science fiction. It's like, no, I have a subscription to Heavy Metal Magazine, the adult fantasy illustrated thing. I love science fiction.
Yeah, yeah.
My brain doesn't go there when I want to tell a story.
Right.
And if I force myself to write it, then I'm going to be writing to a market that I don't understand, that I'm not geared to and pushing. And that's false and dishonest, and it will not be appropriately rewarded.
Well, some kinds of books take their own time,
mm-hmm.
and take their own shape, and if you're the kind of writer who is on that path, you're a slave to that path, I think.
Right.
I mean, you have to follow the book.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you have to do what the muse is telling you to do.
I don't know what my muse is telling me to do anymore.
I never would have thought that I'd have said muse. I would have referred to the muse twice in one conversation. Now I'm going to be self-conscious.
Oh, no. I've referred to the muse a lot lately because I seem to be spinning my wheels in about four or five different directions. You know, I've got one manuscript I'm, you know, sending out, and I don't know, maybe I need to revise it again. You've seen it. And then I've got three other projects that I keep picking up, working on, putting down, picking up. And I have, every month, I've started having a writer's salon in my little tiny apartment.
Oh, cool.
And a bunch of my writer friends and reader friends that, you know, come over, and we get a little hammered and talk story and book and everybody's projects. And now I've got these giant post-it note things all around my, all on the walls of my apartment, where I've drawn diagrams of what I'm trying to do with one of these stories. and you know, when
you're not having trouble with the muse, you've got, you know, your muse is too excited.
It could be it. I had.
You need to calm your muse down.
Yeah. When the cartoonist tells you, well, what's the story? That's what you need to figure out. I think I'm probably a little too much in the weeds.
But yeah.
That's a good thing. I mean, finally.
I think it is too. Isn't the other problem worse for a writer?
Could be. Yeah. Where nothing's there.
Yeah.
It's so hard to get up at 5 in the morning anymore.
Well, if you're expecting me to tell you to quit your day job...
Not
it is
at all.
Hard selling the books after they're written, too.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
It is difficult. But, you know, it all matters.
Yeah.
You know, again, staring at this bookcase, you know, all of these books are books that had to be written. And they had to be published.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just scream out for that. And you know, it's the good work, Jason. It's the good work that you're doing listening to that muse and doing that. You know, it's just, you know, it's such a difficult marketplace these days.
I just wish you would drink some coffee and speed yourself up.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, good for you, you know, that you're doing that, that you're listening to that, all that loud dancing in your room.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Well, at least I'm only doing it once a month with the drinking, because I think I'm getting a little too old for repeated weekend drinking. I mean,
yeah, eventually that happens, man.
Oh, you know, really, here's a good callback for you. When they first put me on the cholesterol medication, I went out and had drinks with friends and realized I could drink like I was 20 again, and I knew that was dangerous.
Really? That's a fascinating side effect.
I know. Well, because the whole statin works on liver function, and suddenly my liver was functioning like it was 20 again.
Wow. Well, be careful, man.
Yeah, I'm trying. Well, that's why I'm trying to go off of the statins, and I've lost 30 pounds in the last year.
Wow. That's great.
And 100 points off the cholesterol score.
Wonderful. Keep going. Keep going.
God, where's this conversation going? Hell, it's a health. And
I don't know. That sounded like the perfect close of a circle to me. All the way around.
Well, I've got a couple more questions before we stop recording. And this one, I think we kind of already brushed up against this one. This is something I ask everybody, but want to get kind of right onto the heart of it. You know, every year, you know, the NEA and various arts organizations come out, you know, with the state of the arts in America. And one of the things I always point out is that literary reading is declining. There was a brief spike in the early 2000s where it went up again. But they're always saying that, you know, people reading novels or plays and poetry is always declining. But at the same time, you know, when we take a look at those sales for ebooks, it's just those are skyrocketing every year.
Yeah.
I tried not to pay too much attention to the hand-wringing, but I find it interesting, though, that sometimes writers seem to be kind of blasé about engaging the larger community to, you know, kind of take a sustainability approach to literature. It seems important that as writers who create something that we want people to read, it's important that we somehow reach out to the community and get people interested in reading. So I was asking, what do you think we as writers, as people, or even as people that are involved with publishing and creating stuff, what can we do besides creating the product to grow that next audience, that to expand the audience to?
Well, you know, you cite the numbers of sales of ebook. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, what's happening is that increasing numbers of people are reading.
Right.
Increasing numbers of books are being written.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that, you know, I try to look at that in as positive a way as I can. There, you know, we talk all the time about the ocean of titles and how do you find the good stuff in the ocean.
Right.
Yeah, and that, I suppose that is a problem. But on the other hand, what it actually indicates, that ocean texts, is that people value writing.
Mm-hmm.
People know what the worth is to the self of writing. People want to be authors of books. People want to put things down in whatever medium. They want their narrative down, and they want it to be read.
Right.
So the basis for how you go forward as a writer, which is increasingly difficult because all of the economic pressures are against you.
Right. The world doesn't want you to write. It wants you to, buy VCRs.
True.
VCRs don't even exist anymore. What am I talking about? God, I'm old.
I mean, true. The culture wants you to go to the Blockbuster movie rather than buy a book, which is why Bezos makes the argument that if books cost too much, mm-hmm. it dampens readership. But I've never met anybody myself who says, "Oh my God, this book costs too much. I think I'm going to take the money and go to a movie."
Yeah.
I mean, people don't say that. So I think you need to begin by understanding that there is a vital literate culture mm-hmm. that is revealed by all of these self-published authors.
Right.
There are people who, granted, they may want you to read much more than they want to read. They may want you to read their books more than they're willing to read anybody else's.
Right.
But it is still a culture of telling your story in a concrete way. And having it read, I think that therefore those publishers or the authors, people who are writing real good and serious work, should be stars. Myself, and you should feel the importance of the work that you do within the culture and talk about it pretty loudly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the argument is going to have to be made at some point that. In order for letters to continue, in order for American literature to remain alive,
right,
we have to find a way to reward the people who write it.
Yes,
and whatever endeavor anyone undertakes with respect to bringing publishing into the next generation, it's got to start with the writer.
Mm-hmm.
And so often, I think the conversation about what publishing is becoming or what publishing has to be
mm-hmm.
or what publishing is going to be forced to be, those conversations start with the reader.
Right.
They don't begin with finding a way to give the author, the investigator, mm-hmm. the canary, the ground to continue to write to us.
Right.
And whatever the campaign is and whatever the perch is, we have to provide that perch for the writer, and mm-hmm. that's what writers should be championing. I think that the authors who came out against Amazon in the battle with Hachette,
mm-hmm.
We're taking that stand. We're being public and vocal about the importance of their work and the importance of their having to be some means of compensating the author.
Right.
So I think being visible in the community is the answer to that.
Right.
And in fighting that particular fight, that what you do is valuable and needs to be supported. Now, how do we do that revolution? I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And how do you get through the misinformation? Because one of the things I noticed was when I've had my interactions with the self-published writers that talk to me about, doing the whole Amazon track, is that I found a post by a guy named John Scalzi, who's traditionally published but has also done some self-publishing stuff. And he pointed out that there's a clause in the Amazon contract that says that they can change the terms of the contract whenever they want. Right?
Yes.
And it's like, okay, so yeah, right now they're being nice to you and say you get 70% of your royalties and you do all this whatever. You have, if they decide to change that, a la Darth Vader, they've got your content from now until they decide to give it up.
Yeah.
No matter, and you can't do anything about it. And that's
the argument has been made, that you. There's a risk in being the subject of a benevolent king.
Right.
You know, and that is the risk. And I don't want to imply that such bad turns are in the offing. I have no idea, but certainly the more biodiverse publishing is,
right,
the more biodiverse book selling is,
yeah,
the healthier the culture will be.
Do you think that maybe we're on the cusp of that, of increasing that biodiversity? Because, you know, independent bookstores seem to be growing again.
They actually are, yeah.
You know, if our, and independent publishers, you know, although they were struggling before conglomeration, they'll struggle, you know, after, you know, in the future. But there seems to be a lot of new small presses cropping up that are doing...
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that just to stick with this term, the biodiversity of literary like political voices,
mm-hmm,
is almost invincible. I mean, I think, you know, that it will out.
Right.
It absolutely will out, and authors will always find a way to get their books, to control the content of their books,
mm-hmm,
and to reach readers with those books. We know whether it's an ebook through Amazon or it's samiz.novels, there will be a way to get what you want to write out to a public. That's going to happen regardless,
right,
of what the corporate forces might be,
right,
and the bottom line forces might be, and the forces of conglomeration, it will still happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's very true. But, you know, it's wonderful to see independent booksellers somewhat on the rebound, but you have to realize that it's just a drop in the, you know, from,
right,
from where they were before McMurray and Beck started and the chains began, and there were independent,
right,
bookstores everywhere. You know, there were thousands and thousands of them,
yeah,
and we are now celebrating, you know, when a couple of them open each, you know, week,
right?
Because it has been such a hard time, and it is wonderful to see that coming back. But there's such a long way to,
right,
go, you know. But I, you know, it's books are the stuff of revolution, Jason.
Oh, absolutely.
And so as long as there are novels to be written and stories to be told, as long as there's narrative,
mm-hmm,
the biodiversity will generate itself.
Right.
It's just an ugly, difficult fight, and sometimes you're on the wrong side of the economic equation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, what are you going to do? Yeah,
you're going to do the good work.
Do the good
work. Point. We're going to fight to fight, and do the good work.
We are. I've often told people that, you know, we're the. We don't ever have to worry about story going away. That's going to be there. I mean, the only thing that really separates us from the rest of the life forms on the planet is that capacity for storytelling.
Yeah, it's hardwired.
It's not language itself. I mean, gorillas have shown they can learn language. You know, it's not tool use. Chimpanzees use tools. It's storytelling.
Yeah.
And
I fully agree.
That's what sets us apart. We invented language to write poetry, and that's the only reason we invented language. Of course, I had a conversation with Taylor Molly, you know, who's actually making a living as a poet and speaker, which, mm-hmm, totally. And he says, you know, it's interesting. You know, we invented language to write poetry, but we invented language for poetry, but we record it in writing that was invented to keep track of debt. You know, it's that marriage of these two opposing, blatantly opposite views of the world, debt and passion, that come together to create this thing we're doing. So it kind of explains why publishing and book writing and everything is so sometimes schizophrenic.
Yeah, that's fascinating, actually.
So that's my big insight for the night.
That's wonderful. That's a thought to pursue.
Cool. I think that went well.
I did too. I very much enjoyed it. I realized that it's been been an hour, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Well, I've enjoyed it a great deal, and I hope you edit out anything that'll get me in trouble.
I don't think anything you said will get you in trouble, Fred.
Oh, you don't know.
Well, if it is, it'll be like, you know, that blog post of mine where it's just we said something that was an opinion that someone just somewhere decided to get about, and
yeah.
That's their deal, not ours.
Oh, that's right. Trouble lasts only, you know, a few days. One news cycle.
Right.
Okay.
Well, don't go anywhere. Thanks for talking to me, though, Fred.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it. Thank you, Jason.
All right. There you have my conversation with Fred Ramey. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to come back in 2 weeks. I'll have another shop talk with Laura Holly. We'll try to continue to improve those. Those need some work. That's just us, for me. We'll get it better. I'll stop saying so much. And then after that, at the end of January, we will have my conversation with Scott Phillips, author of The Ice Harvest, and most recently Hop Alley. That's a good one. So, see you soon.